for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Illegal trade in wildlife is a booming business. Animals are traded for meat, fur, skin, decor, or as exotic pets. While nobody knows how big the illicit trade is, my guest, Brian Christie, says its profit margins are the kind drug kingpins would kill for. Christie's article on wildlife trafficking is in the current issue of National Geographic. He joins us in the studio from Colorado. Public Radio in Denver is U.S. Fish and Wildlife Agent George Morrison. He's featured in Christie's article entitled The Kingpin. You'll find pictures from the article on our website at drshow.org. And you can join us by phone. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Or you can join us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Diane.
Good morning to you, George. Thanks for being there.
Good morning.
Let's start with you, Brian Christie. Tell us about the kingpin, who he is, and how he got into your article.
The kingpin is Anson Wong. He was born Wong Keng Liang. He's an international wildlife dealer living on the island of Penang, which is just off the west coast of Malaysia. He is widely considered by those in law enforcement to be the Pablo Escobar of wildlife trafficking for his illegal smuggling, which took place in the 1990s originally. And he was the target of a major undercover operation called Operation Chameleon that George Morrison led. So he is considered around the world to be one of the top wildlife traders.
Give us an idea of how large this wildlife trading business is.
It is certainly a multi-billion dollar business around the world. The figures don't exist. It's widely reported in most exposés and wildlife crime reports that it's a $6 billion a year industry, second only to the drug trade or third behind drugs and weapons. But in fact, we don't really know. And it speaks to the lack of resources devoted to stopping crime that we don't know.
How many types of animals are we talking about?
Everything you can imagine. Every plant, every fish, every animal has a market somewhere in the world.
So you're talking about birds, snakes, bears, deer, everything.
Everything, and virtually every part of everything as well.
Brian Christie, his article on wildlife smuggling titled The Kingpin appears in the January issue of National Geographic. He's the author of the book The Lizard King, The True Crimes and Passions of the World's Greatest Reptile Smugglers. George Morrison, you were the lead investigator on this Anson case. Tell us how you went about doing your work.
Well, first, let me make a quick correction, and Brian Christie gives me more credit than I deserve. The Operation Chameleon was actually led by Rick Leach, who was my boss at the time. I actually led the investigation on Anson Wong, which was just a portion of Operation Chameleon itself.
Well, outline Operation Chameleon for us first, and then tell us about your place in it.
Operation Chameleon was started about 1993. The Fish and Wildlife Service had noticed a growing black market in reptiles, primarily at that time. And we started looking at the intelligence and different aspects of the industry, and and tried to figure out how we could penetrate this growing industry. We had just finished up a large investigation on citicine birds, and it was clear that reptiles was now the looming market, looming illegal trade in front of us. So we set up several covert businesses. The primary one was in Livermore, California. I actually lived in Hawaii and operated part of the business from that location. And the third location was Reno, Nevada. Hmm. We initially set up as a coral business, and then I started making contacts in the reptile world. And let me say this, from the beginning, it was clear worldwide that Anson Wong was, as Brian Christie puts it, the kingpin in the reptile trade, but not only reptiles, but many other forms of wildlife. But he was taking the lead in this illegal reptile trade at that time. He'd been indicted in the United States in the late 1980s. So he was certainly, as my boss Rick Leach put it, he was the crown jewel of this investigation.
So how much of the wildlife trade was he actually involved in, or was he just one of many?
Oh, he was one of many throughout the world, whether it was Germany, Australia, New Zealand, those are Indonesia, Philippines. These were the major suppliers of reptiles, both legal and illegal. But he was a leader. He was known both when you're talking to the crooks involved in the trade and the legal people in the United States or in foreign countries. The name Anson Wong always came up.
So
some loved him, some hated him.
And how was he finally caught doing what he had been doing for years?
Well, he was originally caught when he was first indicted in the United States by an investigation that centered out of Florida. And it was just an overt, regular investigation, hard-nosed investigative techniques. But they couldn't touch him because he was in Malaysia. Malaysia didn't allow the extradition of him. When we started looking at him, with the branch of special operations started looking at him, I made a slow contact. I knew to press him too hard would let him know who I was or who we were. And I started buying things. Pretty soon he started offering me illegal items. And ultimately, we were freely trading and freely talking back and forth about what we were doing. He was giving me his methods of smuggling, his methods of obtaining the illegal wildlife. And ultimately, I was able to, through this slow contact and gaining his confidence, I was able to lure him into Mexico City.
And then what happened?
I'm sorry?
And then what happened?
In Mexico City, we had originally arranged to get him into Canada, and for a lot of reasons that were unfortunate, he found out about an operation we did in Canada, and right at the last moment, he backed out. It was devastating, all the time and money that we'd put into chasing this guy. And he said, I'll meet you anywhere. I'll meet you in Hong Kong, anywhere in Asia. And the real trick was trying to get him to where we could extradite him. And finally, I was able to convince him to go to Mexico City. Within days of our meeting in Mexico City, he said, this just doesn't feel right. He says, I want to meet somewhere else. He said, if I got caught, if I went, I would be a feather in the cap of the Fish and Wildlife Service if they were able to get a hold of me. And at that point, I had to play hardball with him. I told him it was Mexico City or we were basically done. And he did acquiesce and agree to meet me in Mexico City, and I talked to him a while in the airport, and then just as quick as you can imagine, the federales came out of nowhere. They were everywhere. I knew who they were, but they'd been watching us the whole time. They snatched him up and hauled him away.
But
that
of
was
course,
the last time I saw him for about a
year. He must have fought extradition to the U.S. tooth and nail.
He did. He fought it for 2 years and expended a lot of money doing so.
But he was finally tried. He was indicted and tried. And I gather that these crimes carry something like a penalty of 250 years in prison and a multi-million-dollar fine. But he only got 71 months. How come?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. One, federal wildlife laws have, it's a pretty good stick, but it's nothing like charging somebody under smuggling or money laundering, which were the real hammers that we used for Anson Wong. And this was the unique approach by the Department of Justice to prosecuting Anson Wong. Wong did not go to trial. He pled guilty ultimately. And really, we are limited, and the courts are limited by, at that time, by the federal guidelines. And that is why he received the sentence that he did. But for a wildlife smuggler, especially of the level of Anson Wong, that kind of penalty was unheard of in the United States. It was a great outcome, ultimately.
Of course, it's interesting, Brian, that even while Anson Wong was in prison, his wife was carrying on the business.
Right. Shortly after he was arrested, his wife set up her own wildlife company. Her name is Chia Bing Shi, and the company's name is CBS Wildlife, and she continued to export to the United States. And actually, Anson's own company is called Sungai Rusa Wildlife, and that company also exported during the period Anson was supposed to be prohibited from sending shipments. So there was a period while he was in prison that his business was still selling to the United States.
Brian Christie, his National Geographic article is titled The Kingpin. It appears in the January issue of National Geographic. George Morrison was one of the lead agents for Special Operations, the undercover unit of the U.S. and Fish and Wildlife Service. Short break. We'll be right back. And Brian Christie, I do want to say that the photographs in this article in January National Geographic are just incredible. Describe for us one of the Asiatic black bear, which our listeners can see on our website at drshow.org.
Yes, I have to say that all the credit for the photography goes to Mark Leong, who's a National Geographic photographer based in Beijing, China. And that the photo of the Asiatic bear is one of the most remarkable photographs I've ever seen. And that's the response I've been getting ever since the magazine hit the newsstands. That is an example of a bear being having its gallbladder tapped for its bile. The photo was taken in Vietnam. In Hanoi, you can purchase at restaurants bear bile. You can sit down in a restaurant, look over to your left, and see bears in cages to indicate how fresh the bile you'll get would be. There's a highway outside of Hanoi where there are bear farms. These bears are available. In the case of this photograph, some buyers had come to purchase bear bile fresh. And this is a bear having its... They run a... kind of microsound over the ultrasound over the bear's abdomen to find the gallbladder and then stick a needle in it. It's arresting and tap it for its gallbladder, for its bile.
And then aren't there some cases when they actually remove the gallbladder?
Yes. Yes, in fact, that's an issue of hunting issue around the world where bears are can be poached for, just for their gallbladders, and actually the scenario that George Morrison used to lure Anson to the United States focused on they had been discussing reptiles for a long time, and the lure in this case was, hey, let's look into opportunities in the bear bile market, and that appealed to Anson.
George Morrison, describe that conversation if you can.
Actually, it was a idea brought up by Anson, if I remember correctly. It's been a long time, but he said that he did have contacts for bear bile, and I knew that was a big industry, and that actually it bode well into luring him into Canada, because Canada has so many bears, and that fit well within my scenario for luring him to where we could catch him.
I gather in China, moon bears are actually farmed.
Yeah, there's farming of bears in most of the places that it's done is illegal, and despite that, they are farmed. So.
And China keeps these bears in small cages, and then what happens?
Well, in this instance, and I'll stick to the photograph, which is just outside of Hanoi, they're kept in these small cages and used for their bile. You know, they're kept alive for that purpose. And when they're not necessary any longer, of course, they're parted out. So, and the same happens, there are similar versions happening to tigers. It's a real tragedy. Particularly to our sensibilities on the Western side.
Now, what about the captive breeding of tigers? What's going on here, Brian?
Tigers have been a sort of target of the traditional Chinese medicine for a number of years. There are tiger theme parks throughout Asia, in China, Vietnam, and Thailand in particular. And these are places, they're sort of tiger zoos or tiger circuses where you can go and watch tigers perform, sort of Ringling Brothers-like. Many of these tiger parks have their origin as tiger farms. Originally, they were places where tigers were bred and then killed to be sold as parts for the Chinese medicine market. In 1993, China outlawed that sort of domestic consumption. And these parks, these farms converted to parks. And their official...
Breeding parks?
Yes, exactly.
Breeding parks.
Exactly, right. Tigers, the saying goes, breed like cats. And so you can get a lot of them very quickly, and they continue to grow them. And their official position is, look, this is a tourist attraction. And we have them to bring in tourists to see the tigers perform, feed the tigers. There's a monastery where you can go and pet the tigers in Thailand. And but if you look at the economics in the case of a park in Thailand, they have 40 tigers on display, but they boast 400 tigers behind the scenes, and there's no economic reason for having a backlog of 400 tigers just to display 40. This same place also displays about 10,000 crocodiles, and you can look at the crocodiles and then go over to the restaurant and eat crocodile, and you can go to the gift shop and buy crocodile skins and toenails and things. That they do for crocodiles. They say they don't do that for tigers.
Is there any proof that they don't do that for tigers? What kind of oversight is there, if any?
Yeah, that's the question. The oversight, it varies country by country, and it's these are countries with law enforcement that is really stretched to the limit. There are cultural reasons that sort of disparage wildlife law enforcement. There are laws that are spotty in terms of their ability to enforce laws. Judges don't take these cases seriously. It seems kind of silly to bring somebody in with... for a tiger issue, and so it's a real problem.
But tigers are among those creatures becoming more and more extinct, are they not?
Absolutely. The numbers are plummeting. There, we have in the story, it's there are around 4,000 wild tigers left. That number, there's since we filed the story, that number has, groups have come out and started to put out a lower number in the high 3,000s. It's dropping. And
but those are in the wild.
Those are in the wild.
So if you're talking about breeding farms, you're creating this new breed of a kind of domesticated tiger.
That is the theory. The proponents of tiger farming say, look, you farm cattle. Why can't we farm tigers and slaughter them the way you do cattle? And the problem is, in these countries, there's no law enforcement to sort of put walls around that. And it's costs $5,000 or more to keep an adult tiger alive, but it only costs a couple of dollars for a bullet. So the incentive is set up a tiger farm. If you send out your people, let them kill wild tigers, bring them to you, and we'll use it as a laundry opportunity to both. What would happen is it would vacuum up the wild populations and also create this domestic demand by farming tigers and making it legal.
George Morrison, we've had several callers asking why bear bile is used. What's the significance? What are the various places that bear bile goes?
Well, bear bile has been both a legal and illegal trade in the United States as long as I've worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service, which is since 1984. The legal harvested bears in the U.S., often the bear gallbladder itself is taken out and then it's dried. Then that is sold to primarily Korean marketers, and then they grind it and it's put in to things like tea or other medicines. The big theory always has been that it's been used for an aphrodisiac. I've heard that supported and also discounted, so I'm really not sure what all the medicinal uses are for bear bile.
There's an extraordinary photograph here of inside an Indonesian slaughterhouse where workmen are slitting open wild-caught pythons. How are they used, Brian?
That slaughterhouse, as far as I know, no journalist has ever been allowed inside a slaughterhouse before, a reptile slaughterhouse, and that is a photograph of pythons, and those pythons go from that photograph, which is graphic, to luxury exotic leather companies like Prada and Gucci. That photograph is the beginning of the handbags you see on the streets of New York and California.
Sort of takes your breath away.
It did. I was there, and to get to that floor, they had brought in 600 wild-caught pythons. Each one was in a sort of giant pillowcase, and the only way into that slaughterhouse floor was to walk across the pythons in their bags. And it took a bit of balance, and the methods for killing these snakes are, as with the slaughter of all animals, they can be gruesome.
You also have a photograph of what you call the slow loris. Tell us about that.
The slow loris is a small nocturnal animal with these huge eyes that are good for seeing at night and bad for staying out of pet shops. They're sort of this furry little thing that looks like it's something that Steven Spielberg might have designed. And they are illegal to trade in all of their range states, but they are, in this photograph, they were found at a market in Bangkok called Chatuchak Market. It's a huge outdoor market, and these were secretly for sale. And
for what?
Pets. They look cute and cuddly, and people buy them. The part that is not marketed is they produce a toxin that is produced from a gland in their leg, and they can mix that toxin with their saliva and use it to protect, coat their babies with it. The saliva sort of toxic mix and protect them. And they also bite. And many of these wild animals on this sort of cute wild animal line have their teeth removed with pliers and or ground down. It's just horrible. Yeah.
George Morrison, Brian Christie said earlier, it's hard to get people to take these issues seriously when you're dealing with issues like terrorism, issues like drug trafficking, smuggling of human beings, that sort of thing. I mean, how many agents are there in the United States to deal with this kind of illegal animal trafficking?
Well, let me first say this, that whether it's terrorism or drugs or guns, a crook is a crook. And those who deal in guns generally deal in wildlife, and those who deal in drugs generally deal in wildlife. And terrorist operations are sometimes supported by the wildlife trade. In the United States, right now, I believe our numbers are down below 200. We're allowed to hire as many as 230, I believe, that Congress has set our upper limit at. But attrition continues to take them away, and so we're getting ready to hire another class. But you know, it's a pretty small amount of agents when you think about it.
George Morrison of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm going to go to the phones now. First to Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. Good morning, Mary. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm calling about alpaca pelt products that are sold. They're advertised as being pelts coming from animals that have died naturally. Could you please give me objective information on this? Their products are like plush animals or decorations that have been made from the pelts of they advertise as baby alpacas or just alpacas.
George Morrison, do you have any information on that?
I don't have a lot. Do you know, ma'am, are they imported into the United States, or are they a domestic product?
I'm not sure. I know that in one case the people order the pelts from somewhere else, and I'm not sure if, you know, where their source is.
Okay. No, I have little information on the alpaca industry, but if it's indeed something that's being imported in the United States, it's something that we would regulate, and it'd be worth calling your local agent just to discuss that with them.
Good luck to you, Mary. Thanks for calling to, pardon me, St. Louis, Missouri. Tony, you're on the air.
Good day.
Hi.
Would it be good to change legal system to rate destruction of species or using species to permanently harm continents or regions like Asian perch in the Mississippi River system, pythons in the Everglades, West Nile fever in North and South America? Rate that as a murder law, a removal of statute of limitations, which would mean you will be hunted down and your life will be ruined.
George Morrison, how likely is that?
I think that's extremely unlikely. As much as invasive species are a huge problem, and it's my understanding that there's legislation now being brought forth to help deal with it. But I think that we do need to be reasonable in our approach to enforcement and punishment
Brian
in law
Christie,
enforcement.
He also mentioned those snakes in Florida. That population is growing by leaps and bounds.
It is. It is. Many people saw the photograph in October of 2005 of the Burmese python and the alligator, where the Burmese python has sort of blown out its stomach. And that began.
How did that happen? The python tried to eat the alligator?
Right. It's a little bit of chicken and egg, and there are people on both sides of that photograph, but it looks like the python had tried to eat the alligator and...
And then exploded.
Right.
And that photograph is also up on our website. It's just absolutely extraordinary, but you really can't tell which came first, can you?
No, it's difficult.
But this population in the Everglades is clearer and clearer that the overpopulation of snakes, these large-headed snakes, is really becoming a problem. We are going to take a short break now, and when we come back, you will hear about some other creatures that are equally subject to man and his greed. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, with Congress back in session, we discuss what's in the House and Senate health care bills and consider what a compromise bill might look like with Jonathan Cohn, senior editor of The New Republic, where he writes a health care blog called The Treatment. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back. We're talking about the abuse of creatures throughout the world. And one of the kingpins is this man, Anson Wong. You, Brian Christie, tell me that he's out of prison now and back at doing what he's always been doing. How come?
Well, he's back. He has a wildlife business. It's back in business. He's setting up a new zoo, and he had a zoo before he was sent to prison. What we found in this story, and it was the big challenge of this story, was, you know, this Operation Chameleon and George's takedown of Anson and the whole team that took down Anson was a remarkable story. And we thought to make that story really come alive in current terms that we ought to meet Anson. So that became our primary objective off the bat. He'd never spoken to a journalist before, and could we do it? Well, it turns out we did. We were able to get to him and talk to him, and that he revealed, yes, my whole life up till now has been a specialty in reptiles, but I'm moving to big cats. And that was a major revelation. Is putting in the hands of a guy with his history, big cats, is an amazing and discouraging development. And then we were met with even more surprising news, and that is that I looked at the government regulation of ants and during his period of smuggling and beyond. And a single wildlife official had been the game warden on Anson's island while he was smuggling.
In Malaysia.
In Malaysia. That officer was not fired when Anson confessed to years of smuggling. She was promoted. She went to Kuala Lumpur, the capital, and was made the head of law enforcement for wildlife in Malaysia. And then a couple of years ago, she was promoted again. She's deputy director general of the wildlife department. And I went to see her, and I wanted to know, you know, how could she, what did she think of this guy, and how could she allow him to operate under her nose? And I mentioned his name, and she said, oh, he's my good friend. And then, and I began to think, you know, what if this were Pablo Escobar? And Pablo and the government official responsible for taking Pablo down said, oh, he's my good friend, and then offered to give me a driver and go up and see him personally. I said, oh, I've already been there.
So what this tells you is that the government has a tacit approval of what he's doing.
Absolutely, as spoken by her. She has sent letters out saying that on our watch, we believe Anson Wong has never done anything wrong. And despite his confession in and his plea agreement in the United States, they believe, she says, that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service set Anson up and that he's never done anything wrong, despite hundreds and hundreds of pages of tape transcript and you know, the physical animals. Some of them are the Komodo dragons he smuggled in are available they're on display at the San Diego Zoo.
Let's go to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Hello. I have a couple of questions for you. In the interest of disclosure, I will tell you I own a pet store, and while I don't deal in any of these illegal things that you're discussing, I have two questions. First off, my one question, if you can speak to it, is I wonder why the Asian arowana is still banned for import to the United States, even though it's farmed in great numbers overseas. They microchip them so that they can be tracked back to where they came from and even their lineage. And the ones that are mostly of interest to ornamental fish keepers are so line bred that they have no, they bear no resemblance to the wild species anymore. My college degree is in fisheries management, so I come from a more resource oriented perspective. And one of the mantras that we were always taught in school was that the best way to get people to preserve something is to put a value on it. And as soon as you put an outright prohibition on something, people, especially in developing countries, have no interest any longer in preserving the environment that that animal may come from, because the animal basically has no value for them.
So that's your question. Why is the Asian arowana banned?
Correct. And they're captive raised, but they are. And the other side of the coin on that is, while they are technically banned for import in the United States, and while I know people have gone to jail for importing them, I've also seen plenty of photographs of Chinese restaurants and whatnot in the L.A. area that have these things on.
George Morrison, can you speak to that?
Well, the Asian arowana is a CITES, C-I-T-E-S, which is a Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, which is a all participating countries are part of this treaty organization, and they decide what animals get what particular protection, either a high level of protection, which is Appendix 1, or a medium level. And they make the decision as to what level that animal is on, and at some point people in the industry, like the caller, needs to make some kind of movement or get support to delist the animal, but there has to be scientific support to do that.
Any comment, Brian?
Well, just that when an animal is endangered, and Chris is right, there are a number of species that you can sort of manage. Technically, you can manage, and you can raise them and keep them entirely separate from the wild populations, but that doesn't mean traffickers won't use that opportunity to launder wild-caught animals in, and that's usually one of the concerns of countries.
All right, to Mary in Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for this show. And these agents sound heroic, and what they're fighting is horrific. But we should also consider the horrific animal exploitation conducted on a far more massive scale by the food industry, which most of us support through our food choices, not for any real dietary need, but for mere appetite. Farmed animals are just as sentient, are essentially immobilized for years, force-fed, force-impregnated, inhumanely transported and slaughtered, etc. Animals on farms in this country have no federal legal protection and are exempted from most state anti-cruelty laws. This is something the vast majority of consumers in this country are supporting every day through their food choices.
Brian?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And every society makes its own choices, and they tend to be ugly choices, but they're choices we make, and I agree. Yeah.
But George Morrison, one emailer, says, what about the industries that use products like these pythons that are pictured here that go to designers for the creation of handbags and briefcases and the like? Why not crack down on the bag makers and designers using these?
Well, we certainly do crack down on them when we find that they're dealing in illegal wildlife. How the animals are treated overseas, we have no jurisdiction over that. That needs to come from the industry itself to say, we are not going to buy items made from animals that are treated in this way, or the animals need to be treated in a certain way. So
but,
we have no jurisdiction.
Aren't there any restrictions on the importation of those animal skins and the like?
There are limitations, and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service certainly supports the use of wildlife that's taken legally, but we strictly regulate the use of those animals and the overuse of those animals.
All right. To Tallahassee, Florida. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Sure.
Okay, I'm calling. There's a movie with Matthew Broderick from, I believe, the late 80s. I'm not sure. It's called The Freshman, in which either through Marlon Brando's character or he himself is the smuggler, he's assigned to pick up and transport, I think, what is a Komodo dragon, actually, for ultimate consumption. He doesn't know that he's going to be doing this, and he doesn't know why he's doing it. And I'm just sort of wondering whether what's portrayed in that movie, albeit it's a comedy, but whether the ultimate outcome of it and the way that the trade is presented has any reflection on the way the illegal trade really works.
Brian.
Yeah, that's a Komodo dragon lookalike. They portray it as a Komodo. I think it was a water monitor, but it's nevertheless a very large lizard. It was a comedy, and yet it wasn't. The idea that as I recall the movie, it was sort of this private club of people who paid extra money to eat critically endangered species. And in a way, that's what all of this is about. These are people wanting to consume the ungettable, is one word that they use. We want to consume the things at the very end of their genetic lines, critically endangered species, because no one else can have them. And so in that way, it's very telling.
Brian, I know you met yesterday with Senator Bill Nelson on the issue of reptiles. Tell us about that.
I did. I met with his staff. Senator Nelson is on the Senate side, has introduced a bill originally the bill was to ban all python imports and the interstate trade of pythons. That bill was reported out of committee last month, and was the number of prohibited snakes was both curtailed and expanded. It's no longer all pythons, it's what they're calling giant snakes. So the bill would ban several giant pythons, a couple of anaconda species, and the boa constrictor. And as I understand it, their principal impetus for this was the pythons that have established themselves in the Everglades, that alligator and the python.
Do we have any idea how many are there?
Early on, I spoke with one of the guys tasked with regulating this area, and his number was, we estimate 150,000 Burmese pythons loose. Since then, that number has I haven't heard that number discussed. And some of this is guessing. You know, these are cryptic these species hide easily, and they're hard to discover. Certainly there are thousands. These animals produce 80 to 100 eggs in a clutch. And so they can, if you remember your math problems from high school, those sort of numbers pairing together and pairing together can quickly produce very large numbers.
And what is their presence doing to the Everglades?
Well, anytime they're a high-end predator. They don't have, once they reach adulthood, they don't have many things to fear. And so sitting at the top of a food chain like that, they can do a lot of damage. Anytime you introduce a foreign player into an ecosystem, that ecosystem is put out of whack.
And now how do we think they got introduced into the ecosystem?
Certainly the overwhelming theory is that pet owners have released them. There's also been a couple of major hurricanes down there, and I know of one scenario where, you know, there are some major wildlife dealers down there, and some of their facilities are fairly flimsy construction-wise. And Andrew blew out the walls on some of these facilities, and those animals got loose. So that's another source.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Greensboro, North Carolina. Good morning, Scott.
Hello, Diane Rehm.
Hi.
Thank you so very much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was about that legislation that's being proposed. As I understand it, it'll make the trafficking of any large snake, boa constrictor, python, Burmese, anaconda across state lines a federal smuggling charge. And the information that I gathered was that there was a 300-page document put out that estimated the populations of the pythons in the Everglades, but it included global warming and other factors to actually give them a habitable population along the South Gulf Coast and on the East Coast. My question would be... just to ask your panelists to comment on the details of those numbers, that book that's been put out that the senator is using to promote this legislation.
Brian.
Sure. The book was a study by the U.S. Geological Service, and it's come under fire for not being adequately peer-reviewed, according to its critics. Those critics would like this process generally is a fish and wildlife process. It's their responsibility generally to make these determinations about what species are injurious to the United States, but they don't have the money, and there's species after species that they can't do this sort of thing. There's 161 special agent field agents in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The FBI has 13,000 agents. The DEA has 5,000. We have 161 devoted to wildlife crime, and so in part because Fish and Wildlife Service is overwhelmed, it's become a legislative issue, and the legislature has more primitive tools in a lot of respects to address problems, and this is the result.
So, George Morrison, do you see any possibility of new laws restricting the crossing of state lines with these endangered species, these snakes, other creatures?
Right now, yes, there's laws that prohibit the interstate commerce of endangered species. But if the law is constructed like most legislation is, there will be restriction on movement in interstate commerce, and Fish and Wildlife Service would then get involved. It'd be more than just a state issue. No. But that's just a guess. I haven't seen the legislation nor know of it.
And Brian Christie, finally, how is the demand for these creatures going to change? How do you see it developing in the next 10 years?
Well, I think what these people are trafficking is rarity. And as human development increases, as global warming has these sort of unexpected impacts where it will, certain species require certain temperatures when they lay eggs at certain temperatures, those eggs will produce females at different temperatures, very small changes that will produce males. Global warming can totally shift the development of entire species by shifting the balance of males and females. And we're going to see more and more man-induced rarity, and that's like creating one-of-a-kind pieces of art.
Brian Christie. His article on wildlife smuggling, titled The Kingpin, appears in the January issue of National Geographic. George Morrison was one of the lead agents for Special Operations, the undercover unit of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who arrested Anson Wong, the world's most notorious wildlife dealer. Thank you both for your work and for being with us.
Thank you, Diane.
And you're thanks welcome. For listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.